Is this one on? Is it better? Oh, thanks. It's because it's on your side, Peter. Not because it's better. But good morning and welcome to this joint sitting of, I'm not too sure how many committees, but I know the provincial and the... I can't count beyond two. Okay, good morning to this joint sitting of portfolio committees. To get a briefing from National Treasury on this asset transfer regulation to the Municipal Finance Management Act. I want to take this opportunity to welcome all of you in the new year and wish you all the best and a very busy year. And I trust that you rested well with all the other programs that we had to go through. Mr. Pillay, I'm trying to get the list of your team. If I can't get it when you start, you will just do us the favor of introducing your team as well from National Treasury and whoever else I may have missed. I see things have really changed because the media has actually joined us inside the... Were you locked out? But then who let you in? what's happening, Bradley? Why are the doors to the gallery locked? Oh, okay. But for now, you are under temporary amnesty. You can stay there, and whilst you sort out, I know you feel very comfortable up there. Oh, now I've got something, Mr. Pillay. I'm being called to order here. Because I normally sit here when only the Portfolio Committee on Finance is here. But I did say that it's a joint sitting of portfolio committees. The other two committees other than finance that are with us are the Provincial and Local Government Portfolio Committee, but also the Minerals and Energy Portfolio Committee, represented ably here by... the team is led by their whip, Mr. Semlo, who holds a number of positions in Parliament. He's also the programming whip. He's very intimidating when he walks into meeting. I wanted to welcome a new member in the Committee on Finance, Mr. Dr. Dion George, who has just joined us. We remember that last year when we closed in the Portfolio Committee on Finance, we only had one member after Mr. Gibson was deployed in a foreign mission, and we wish he's doing well. And we welcome you, Dr. George. We trust that you'll enjoy working with us, and we're looking forward to working with you. You're welcome. Without wasting time, I see that as is tradition, when there are more than one committee, we start a little late. Mr. Pillay appears before finance all the time. We've never been late. We're only late because there's local government. Yeah. I was still looking for local government. But here we are. If you can take us through, Mr. Pillay, without wasting time, now that you've been introduced. The team is led by Mr. Pillay from National Treasury, and there's Wendy Fanu from Local Government Finance Policy in National Treasury, and then Mr. Mkholi Sindlovu, who's also responsible for the MFM implementation. Where is... Oh, Mr. Dove is in the middle. Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry, Jefferson.
Thank you, Jefferson. I hope the mic system is working. Okay, thank you. And to all the members, I wish you well for 2008 as well. Members will recall that the MFMA requires many pieces of regulations and framework guidelines, and this is one of those that is now being prepared and presented to this committee. After, I would say, a year or so of work in this regard, what we would like to cover today very briefly is to provide a summary of the progress made, to provide an update on the draft regulations that you have in front of you. By the way, you should have a copy of the presentation, the exemption notice that was issued, and the regulations with the explanatory memorandum contained therein. I hope you all have that pack available with you.
Can I request that copies be made available to members? You know, these were sent to members at the very wrong time when we were just about to break for constituencies.
There's copies available as well.
Yeah.
For the meeting today.
Those that haven't got copies, if you could just indicate those, passed on to you. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Members and colleagues, I think the process in summary then needs to be captured so that we put it into context. The terms of reference for asset transfer framework was developed way back in July 2006 based upon the need arising out of various reviews and reforms in municipalities and the need to address a more structured way in which asset transfer arise. The inception report was produced in August 2006 based also upon local and international research that was conducted during September and October. The basic principles that you find in this piece of regulation now framework, you will see does capture much of the research work and international best practice. The draft framework then was developed around January, February, month 2007. There was a meeting and a presentation made at the Mineral and Energy Committee around that time as well. Further consultation on the draft then arose, both internally and externally with key stakeholders. A reference group was formed to develop this, given that this is the first type of draft framework that has been put in place. Even with the international research that we've been through, in various countries through desktop studies and other kind of analysis of guidance and frameworks, we found that there isn't very much empirical and legal framework of this nature around. So it was something that has to be developed from scratch to try and put together a piece and a process framework that really addresses the whole issues around governance, issues around taking into account our own legal framework underpinned from the Constitution, from the MFMA, from the Systems Act, and other pieces that then flowed around the policies that were developed in government. So the consultation then arose. A second draft was prepared. Further consultation took place with a number of government departments as well. The Minerals and Energy Department, the Land Affairs, Housing Department, the DPLG. And we tried to incorporate as much of their comments on the initial stage as possible into the draft, so it is quite a comprehensive and consultative version already being produced. But having said that, we then had a third draft prepared through this process, and hence part of that and the input from the various committees that were made during various other presentations, input from various role players. We are now at this point in time where we managed to publish a draft prepared for discussion as well and further comment in the public domain. But the plan of action would be, as can be stated, to try and finalize the and promulgate this now around February. So it will be concluded. So it is quite a long timeline that was set for it, given the nature of the content. Now, the summary of progress generally was when a further round of comments was circulated in January and around February, we had a stakeholder session where we called representatives from selected municipalities, from the district, from locals, from municipality, from metro municipality, and other practitioners in municipalities, national departments and provincial departments. We had two or three of these meetings to try and get a sense of a real working document. So it was getting hands dirty kind of approach to get this thing in place. And that was very constructive in ensuring that what we do produce now and what we discuss now is then broadly reflective of the views. The comments of all stakeholders then were considered, and of course we are now at a stage where at the point in time when we had a discussion with the Energy Committee, it was requested that an exemption be produced in the interim while waiting for the framework to be developed. I think that we obliged with and immediately started preparing that. One is the exemption notice you have in your pack as well. That was produced in April to facilitate some of the transfer, especially around the restructuring of electricity. Following the process and further discussion and final approval and the concurrence of the Minister of Provincial and Local Government was achieved to arrive at this version. The background to this, and I think it's clear that we have to look at some key principles first to be able to put this document together. Since with members looking at it in more detail now, and we welcome that, you would note a number of technical aspects being discussed. And we will talk to those technical aspects as well along the way in this presentation. But the MFMA has identified the need to provide a framework through regulations for the transfer of capital assets to another municipality for the basis of this come through municipal entity or to a national or provincial organ of state. Now, so there is a limitation in which the scope in which this regulation has to fall within. The MFMA also allows for regulations to be made for safeguarding of the financial affairs of municipalities and entities and its assets, liabilities, staff are transferred in terms of elimination of letting disposal of assets. Those are provisions broadly captured in the MFMA and where in which the foundation was being laid to prepare these guidance of regulations. There has been other aspects covered as well that link up with this, that gives effect to this and closes the broader net around asset transfer and disposal. But the House must remember it's largely municipal assets that's affected here. And in that context, driven by the MFMA. So in the context, you would not find PFMA being quoted in this piece of legislation. It was not necessarily drafted in terms of the PFMA, but rather in terms of the MFMA. The application of the regulation then applies for municipalities and municipal entities, of which it's been published, a number of municipal entities around, it's on the Treasury website as well, and it's been shared with the finance committees and other committees during their research last year. Applies to transfer and disposal of all municipal capital assets, as well as hiring out arrangements. Does not apply to PPP, certain aspects generally regarded as investments, which is covered in the investment regulations issued by under the MFMA already 2 years back. With certain transactions involving transfer of land to beneficiaries of the Labyrinth land. We had engagements with the Department of Housing as well on this matter, and we're deferring initiatives around the right of use of land and other initiatives to the policies underpinned by those sectors. So if you have a cross reference to cost, you'll see that in the regulation. The governing principles, though, I think this is the key part of the asset transfer framework. The method of valuation has been a point of contestation, various different approaches have been followed. There's been different accounting standards laid. There's a whole range of issues affecting valuation. And hence, one of the key principles we're saying is the value must be attained to the transfer or disposal of capital assets so that no party is prejudiced in terms of the transfer. Funding invariably from a municipal environment for any of these assets that we talk about would have been achieved either by grants through its own revenue raising abilities from its citizens and ratepayers, or from another alternative which could have been through borrowing. So the valuation of these assets have to be quite clearly put out and spelled out. The next key principle is around the continuity of service. When a capital asset used in a municipal service is transferred, the service must continue without interruption. Now that is, we're all aware of the challenges around service delivery and disruptions and the causes and the effects of those. So that's the next key principle is continuity of service. Risk transfer, when a capital asset is transferred, the risk attached to that asset must also be transferred. It's another key principle, and I think rounded off in many other pieces of legislation. The asset preservation. And here the recent challenges we all know about, but largely it's around ingrained, discriminant or unsustainable transfers that undermine the ability of municipality or its entities to provide or expand services, and these have to be considered. So, generally those are the principles. The next big area of work that went into developing the framework was around clarifying certain of the provisions of the MFMA that may not have been defined so clearly, even in the MFMA, and as we started to work through the framework, it was decided that a more clear definition be provided in some of these areas. So the best attempt was made at providing these, again with a whole range of consultation taking place. Now, the municipal capital assets are effectively a very large subset of municipal assets. So if you look at the financial statements, where the technical part comes in, of a municipality, you'll see a whole list of assets through an asset register being prepared. So they cover property, they cover plants, they cover equipment, they cover offices, they cover vehicles, they cover, you name it, it's all there, it's part of the asset. And that's the kind of larger subset we refer to. Municipal must decide whether the capital assets they intend to transfer or dispose is a high-value capital asset. Now, we'll explain this a little further, but we decided, because there's so many assets that will fall under the capital asset category, from a small value to a large value, that it will become quite cumbersome to ensure everything is followed through in the meticulous process that we do put out here for public assets. All capital assets with high value or not will be regarded as either exempted or non-exempted. That's the way that the chapters have been drafted. And to ensure there's a much more clear step-by-step approach in either of these instances. Subsidy assets are assets that are linked to capital assets, and the Ministry does not need to consider these assets as high value or otherwise, as they may be either. Now, subsidiary assets, if you transfer a function, one would know that there's other types of assets that must go along with it, or else that function cannot be transferred as an operational function, or disposed of, or it has other implications for the performance of that function. Now, given in a municipal environment, not like national and provincial departments, where you only have one kind of function being performed, in a municipality you have a multitude of different functions, and they all have some bearing on the different type of assets that are being used to give effect to those services. Depending on the nature of the assets, they will either be regarded as exempt or not, to discuss that. The exempted and non-exempted assets, before considering the transfer or disposal of a capital asset, the municipality must first ask itself if the circumstance of the transfer is exempt from Section 14 to Section 14 or 19. Now, Section 14 is the enabling provision in the MFMA. We have not specifically copied you with that section. If somebody still needs it, we can let you have a copy very quickly. I'm sure somebody can run and make photocopies of these. But they are generally the provisions contained in the MFMA. And Chair, if you will just indulge me on this point, please. It talks about disposal of capital assets, and it talks about a municipality may not transfer ownership as a result of a sale or other transfer, or otherwise permanently dispose of a capital asset needed to provide a minimum level of basic municipal service. Now that is another key fundamental foundation for which this thing has been drafted. That the due respect has been given to members, and the way that the law has been drafted was giving protection to municipalities' ability to continue to deliver a minimum level of basic municipal services. That was a long debate during the drafting stage. I think that's the main provision there that I want to highlight. And further to that, there's a few steps around Section 14. Section 90 deals specifically with entities with a very similar provision around municipal entities. So, in a nutshell, that's where we are. The next big point on Section 14 that should be noted is that municipal councils have to decide on reasonable grounds that an asset is not needed to provide the service. Similar issues have been then crafted through here, and the team has come through, has considered the fair market value and the economic and community value to be received in exchange for the asset. In the legislation, Section 14.3, a decision by council for a specific capital asset not needed to provide the minimum level of service has to be made. If that is made, then it may not be reversed by the municipality after the asset has been sold, transferred, or otherwise disposed. So it's already setting the regime around asset disposal, putting that context. The municipal council may delegate to the accounting officer certain powers to determine in terms of the section the respect of movable capital assets below a value determined by council. Now, the threshold you see here and the high value initiative has come about out of consultation with practitioners and officials and others to say we need to give some guidance in the legislation of the threshold without not necessarily taking the power away from council to decide, as it is correctly stated in the law, below a value determined by council. So council may even go a lower value than what is in here. Okay, I think that largely is the kind of initiatives, and then again the supply chain system provision comes through. Committee members would also know then that there is a direct link between this and the Municipal Systems Act, in which Chapter 8, the review of service delivery mechanisms when an organ of state is prepared, a reorganization of powers and functions between a municipality and its entities, and these are the kind of steps on the exemption notice and non-exemption of assets, adjustment of a municipal powers and function or boundaries through legislation, so national legislation will affect that as well, and then initiatives can take place. Transfer of municipal land to a national or provincial organ of state for housing for the poor in terms of national or provincial housing policy. That's what we mentioned earlier. So the exemption part is then covered. Broadly, if the answer to the question is no around exemption, then the asset is regarded as a non-exempt, meaning that the provisions of Chapter 2, which we'll discuss very briefly now as well, will apply. So we split the chapters in the regulation in certain ways. If the answer to the question is yes, this is the kind of decision-free approach that will follow, then the asset regarded as exempt, meaning that part of Chapter 3 is exempt. So it's giving a clear regime of a yes, no, and an approach to follow. And hopefully once this is concluded, we will produce a guide for practitioners based upon this to give them a much more clear decision-free kind of approach to how to apply the regulation if it seems complicated. Then evaluation of assets. There were four types: depreciation, replacement cost, the cost to replace the asset less depreciation to take account of age and condition, I think that's a clear accounting terminology, all of these, fair market value, and we're trying to define it more clearly, historical cost of adjustment, the original purchase price less any adjustment for depreciation and impairment, asset preservation, the amount that could be obtained from the transfer less cost. Now these have been discussed as well, given the context of where the new accounting standards are moving, for municipalities. So they would, in that context of the reform, as we move forward. It is a choice, though. One must understand that the challenge of the roles where they were, the municipalities in many instances apply different standards, either one of these could apply to them based upon the accounting principles and policies they use. So in order to get this right, there's an option in which a choice has to be made, in which way to follow on the valuation. But it is a fair approach, it's clear, it's scientific, and it's an approach that will give you an auditable result in the end. So I think that's clear for tracking purposes as well. Transfer, disposal, and the rights or use, there's a challenge that came about during the development that we also need to deal with alienation, but perhaps as well the right of use. In some instances there are lease type arrangements that go beyond scope, but section 168 does capture the other administrative parts of the finance kind of regulations that require to be put in place. And the right of use issue came about. So let's deal with the transfer, where ownership of the asset is transferred as a result of a sale of a similar transaction or similar. Disposal refers to a process when ownership is lost other than through a transfer, which could be the first part. For instance, when an asset is demolished, it can be dismantled or it can be destroyed. So there's various ways of dealing with it, and it has to be addressed within the municipal finances, within its assets, within its financial statements and its status. The right to use, control, and manage may include a lease, letting, or hiring out arrangements where ownership is not lost or transferred. Now, this is also an issue where municipalities may have entities and they wish to transfer some of these assets to its own entity or outside use, but the assets revert back to the municipality after the contracting period is over, or should they just establish the entity that they created, assets can revert back to the municipality. So there are issues here that impact more collectively. Other definitional points that came up were the functions versus the services. Now here, there's a power and function regarding an activity that municipality or municipal entity is legally allowed to perform. Constitution sets those out quite clearly, schedules of it, and that's where we've taken the lead from. However, there's some other type of municipal services. It's a function that is considered to be a service, which is done for the benefit of the community. Now, they're not necessarily specifically listed on that schedule, but other type activities, development needs, economic activities, various other issues that may surface from time to time. And some of the research pointed to us to need to do this. Commercial service that is rendered by a private sector party or organ of state on a commercial basis. Now, certain municipalities have an issue that runs its IT. It could be an IT firm doing its IT operations, or it could be within the municipality. So these are other types, commercial type activities that lends itself to procurement of goods and services and the like. So here, parties to a transaction, organ of state, the national, provincial, or local government, that's very clear. We try to maintain that throughout. It's coming from the Constitution, so any definition or challenges around what is that is quite clearly. Private sector party, person who is not an organ of state, that's very clear, and a service provider, which is what we just discussed now. Then getting into some of the other bigger issues around I'm also taking from the premise here that members would have at least had a chance to see the explanatory memorandum, but if not, here I think it's very just certain one or two clear issues. The need to improve transparency, accountability through a practical framework, but in the explanatory memorandum. The need to, the enabling provisions around the regulation, dealing both with the transfers to private sector parties, other municipalities, and granting of temporary right of use, we explained. The issue around capital assets and assigned includes all immovable assets. Explain a part of that in the opening. Capital assets must have a lifespan of at least 1 year. That's some of the bigger challenges. Then, something that perhaps needed to be known quite easily, the process to transfer or dispose of high-value assets must commence with a request to
council to authorize public participation vote. Because it is owned by the council, by the community, and that's where it should start. A high value asset is an asset that defines value in excess of 1 million or 5% of the total of the municipality's assets. So that's setting a benchmark or a threshold, whichever way you want to call it. The request must be accompanied by a comprehensive information statement so that it does show certain initiatives being taken before the time. It shows the reason for the proposal, the asset value, the benefits of the proposal, anticipated proceeds or loss that could be expected if the proposal went ahead. In some instances, communities would have paid for that, so there's a borrowing attached to that asset. What will happen to that liability in a municipal environment thereafter should an asset be then disposed of in service? So these are quite good principles for upfront transparency. The other big one is that it must be open to the public. So it's not done behind any closed doors, these asset disposals. It's all up there in the public domain. And further other basic stuff, I think that's quite clear. That's something that this needs to reinforce. In some instances, there's a reorganization of function between a municipality and its entity, and some of this needs to be captured as well. An adjustment of powers we spoke about. Generally, it's quite a holistic piece that covers it in a more transparent and sustainable way. I think the next big issue is about to ensure that if an asset that has been bought with community funds, public funds, that do revert back for continuity of service, clear that point up. And then again, a further issues around what falls within, what falls outside the criteria, we've explained that. The other big principle along the area is generally a municipality or municipal entity must receive a fair market value for such assets. However, where the plight of the poor or public interest demands otherwise, it is possible to consider a lesser value provided the following is taken into account. Interests of the state and local communities, strategic and economic interests of the municipality or entity, constitutional rights and legal interests of all parties, whether the interests of the parties to the transfer should carry more weight than the interests of the wider community. So it broadens that out. Where the local community would be better served if the asset is transferred at less than fair market value. So these are some things still have to be considered. It's part of the framework. It's in there. We're just trying to set it up a bit more clearly. I think that then gets us into the meat of the various chapters, how it's being drafted. We covered definition and governance in the first chapter, and we had an extensive, much more extensive presentation now on that point. Then coming to how we did with a non-exempted capital asset. There has to be public participation in order to get kind of buy-in, community consultation processes being done, and knowing that assets are not then removed out of the entity, out of the municipality. Assets needed to render municipal services, these are non-exempted type of services. If there's a conditional approval, yes, there's a regime around you want to transfer, but there's a condition that transfer will. We can explain that as well. To be in accordance with the disposal management system, in terms of the supply chain, one would realize that supply chain regulations cover some of this. There's a procurement system, so there's a purchasing, there's also one of that deals with the disposal management. So they should be able to dispose of the assets in a specific way. Compensation, if there's any compensation, what is the compensation based on the valuations we provided? Others, competitive bidding process, should we go that route? And what are the issues around competitive bidding? Discharge of borrowing arrangements, if there's a loan, long-term loan associated or a big loan associated with the purchase of that asset, what's going to happen to that liability? And then various transfer agreements, the contents of those transfers. In chapter 3, exempted capital assets now. So then circumstances where we consider the exemption. Identification of exemption, the assets needed to render the minimum service, what happens to them, special conditions against that, transfer of borrowing, transfer of staff here is an issue that will arise. and one needs to consider this quite carefully. And it's been considered, the compensation, valuation, transfer. Of course, then there's a due diligence that has to be performed, so that one does have the empirical evidence that that whatever has to be transferred has been well thought through, the structure is right, the ownership is right, the issues around good governance and accountability is taken care of. Any other delegations, and then we do the entity. Chapter 4, the right to use, control or manage. Public participation requires for assets greater than 10 million. Because when you want to dispose of a small vehicle that had its day, I think it's going to be quite cumbersome to go this route. So the committee that worked through the development of this decided that 10 million would be a right kind of threshold level that will solve the challenges. But depending on which municipality you are, you may want to go lower so the council can take some of those decisions. Any other considerations to be cognizant of the disposal management system? We mentioned transfer concerning municipal functions. It's going to be important to also consider continuation of municipal services. We spoke about earlier the contract agreement is going to be more important. Quite often, when some of these transactions have been taking place over the last while, the contract agreements have been very weak. Contracts are written one-sidedly, and it's not in a way that is balanced. Quite often, in municipal environments, they lack the contract management skills to ensure that the contracts are managed in the appropriate way. And often, you know, only very few municipalities have got that skill. The big ones are Joburg and other big cities. But others just prepare a contract, expect it to be done, not manage it quite appropriately. And so there are key issues around content of contracts. Encumbrances, rights and servitudes are covered in the end, and the exemption. This slide generally just provides the decision tree. I think it's too small to even read on your pages, so apologies. This is just a flavor of what we will try to attempt to put in a guide once this is then finalized. So it starts to give people a sense of, if you do this, these are the circumstances, then follow that route, if not, follow the next route. So I think that's basically just describing the decision tree moving from chapter 1 and 3. And I've spoken about that already. Now, chapter 2 of this is a real... the chapter deals with non-exempt capital assets. This chapter prescribes requirements for the transfer of disposal of assets, not exempt from sections 14.2 and 19.2. I've read 14.2 out, 19.2 is a replication of it, as part of the MSMA provision. This includes all transfers resulting from anything outside of those listed in Chapter 3. So, have Chapter 2 on the one side, dealing with non-exempt assets, have Chapter 3 on the other side. So if you open them, you will see the regime that follows in a kind of way that tries to carve it out. It has been quite a challenge to reorganize it in a way that makes it more easy. Hence, the decision tree approach would be much, much more user-friendly. So this includes all transactions, so we covered it. It is applicable when the transfer is the result of an ordinary commercial transaction. So that's Chapter 2. When the transfer is the result of an ordinary commercial transaction through a competitive bidding process. So it's quite clear then how the decision tree will flow. For example, the sale of a tractor no longer required for municipality, so an individual will follow this route. The disposal, non-exempt, removed. This chapter does not apply to PPPs or certain other housing transactions. Be clear. The transfer disposal of non-exempt capital assets, is the asset considered to be high value? That's one of the big issues. If it is, a public partnership process must be authorized and follow the information. Will the asset be needed to provide minimum service? If yes, whether high value or not, before making a decision, then council has to take certain factors into account, including the credit rating of the municipality, in instances where credit rating will be affected for its own standards in the institution. Council may only then approve in principle, so there's a decision of council saying, yes, go ahead, in principle approve the transfer. Once approved, the assets must be transferred or disposed of in an appropriate manner. Then the accounting officer, the municipal manager, takes responsibility, follow the disposal management process in the supply chain, and moves ahead. So that, depending on the circular council, may be able to negotiate directly with the selected bidders, so there's opening up of the debate to get better arguments in. It must then be considered agreed compensation and finalized and published the transfer document. So the decision tree approach we spoke about, capital assets not exempt, is the asset considered high value? If so, consider public participation. So this is quite clearly spells out then how we need to follow the process to consider compensation and then finally transfer. So that's the easy way out to do things. Now we have another way which deals with Chapter 3, the exempt capital assets. Now this provides requirements for transfer of assets to organs of state in terms of the exemption contained in 14 and 19. Competitive bidding here is not relevant because it's another organ of state. So then you can move across in your mind another track of how we deal with transfer to other organs of state. Transfer is guided by the MFMA and other legislation, MFA, in these transactions, assets need to be minimum level, and that we spoke about. That assets needed for minimum level of basic services are not excluded. Outsourcing of water service by municipality and municipal service utility. Those are just an example. This chapter is not relevant to PPPs, it's set down. Now, the transfer of exempt capital assets, will the assets be needed to provide a minimum service? Depending on the nature of the transfer, it is required to provide such services, and the municipality must first satisfy itself that the transferee can adequately safeguard or maintain the assets. So there's now a process to be followed. Consider imposition of conditions, ownership to revert back if the services can't continue. We spell that out, and the reason for that, provide the minimum services. If a transfer results from a review of service delivery mechanism, municipal must review feasibility studies. These work would have been done already. So we mustn't interpret this as a complete new process. We think this can be then followed. If those feasibilities have been done, then you move ahead because the information, empirical information and background research for that decision to come is done already. Consider the impact of the transfer on cash flows and financial position. It is important that this be considered given the way that the legal framework addresses municipalities. Municipalities are meant to continue to collect their own revenue in the way that they are supposed to do in respect of their autonomy and other related matters. We do need to be sure then that any removal of an asset from the municipality is well captured in a proper due process so that if the municipality is assets are transferred, that municipality is still less sustainable at the end of the day to operate. So there's definitely a rationale to look at cash flows, how it will affect the municipality and financial position of the municipality. When an entire function is transferred, a water service function, for example, as different to individual assets, all capital and subsidiary assets must also be ring-fenced to make that service operational, or else it's just not going to happen. And transfer. So they may include staff in that process. And here we are deferring to labor relations as well, legislation that covers labor relations. In terms of the decision tree, identify all assets, including staff, to be transferred. Is the asset needed to provide the service? If so, ensure the organ of state can safeguard, maintain, impose conditions. Ownership revert back on non-performance. In some way, there is that governance challenge that's going to arise where local councillors will be accountable to the community for certain services and functions that still have to be continued, irrespective of the mechanism chosen to perform the service. So we have to look at what happens in the instance of failure to perform. Is a transfer an initiative of municipality? If so, then continuous service, a similar kind of key principle on subsidy matters. Other decisions on compensation to be paid. If there's issues around funding constraints and initiatives around sustainability, those decisions will have to be taken by the council. At the end of the day, organs of state to undertake due conditions that's clear and the finance finalized as well in the end. So there are two chapters coming. One is clear for competitive bidding, one is clear for open bidding. And the next chapter deals with transfer of a right to use, control, or manage. Does the asset have a value above greater than 10 million? Now we can choose 5 million, we can choose 2 million. But 10 million was there. I'm just almost three more, four more slides and I'll be done, Shepherd. If it does a public participation process informal information statement similar to that provided by the proposal, must be authorized. Will the asset be needed for to provide municipal service? The same theme follows. Here we talk about for indefinite or undetermined period, for a period that exceeds the usefulness of the asset. So these are issues that around the quality of assets, the content, how long must the transfer be for, what kind of conditions then are to be set in line with it. The above issues, Chapter 2, sounds fair. Okay, I think we've covered most of this. Is the proposal, again, considered long-term high value? If so, the same public participation process. So you can see the theme of ensuring that there's transparency. Minimum service protection, again, is important. The theme around transfers in terms to be done in accordance with supply chain policy, if not, decide whether to undertake competitive bidding. So there is a choice then available. Consider compensation and a very similar approach. So it's been clearly split up in different ways depending on which approach, on whether it's the organs of state, private entity, or letting. There are certain exemptions, and when we looked at it quite carefully, the regulations do not apply here to municipal securities or guarantees provided to the lender for collateral against borrower. It is something to protect the contractual obligation between a lender and a borrower. So something in terms of law has been addressed more appropriately. Transfer of money owed by consumers to a collection agent. If there's other contractual obligations there, you've got to respect those contractual obligations. Cash or investments made in terms of the investment regulation policy, as covered again by the investment regulation policy. Municipal security deposits required for goods and services. Prepayment in terms of short-term insurance, and then related transfer of non-exempt capital assets in terms of PPP agreements. Then also covered by agreement, housing on municipal land for the poor to beneficiaries of housing. So I think those are the kind of broader exemptions. Now the key issues in the regulations are crafted to ensure that the assets in the particular needed to protect minimum basic service are only transferred after due consideration, so and community consultation. Now this can arise as well out of IDP process, for example. The municipalities are going through community consultation process through the integrated development plan. Some of these initiatives are starting to unfold. It cannot be an unplanned exercise that tomorrow we'd like to dispose of an asset. Let's do it. Rather have it within the structured process of the IDP. So we know that the issue around community consultation has also been covered there. So again, it may not, must not be seen as a duplication of initiatives around consultation. I think some can misunderstand that. As long as it's part of the consultation process, I think that's what we intended. All transfer must be transparent, fair, reasonable, accountable for decision making, and then maintain consistency with other local government legislation. Before going to the way forward, this legislation, this regulation now, has been drafted using the same advocate that drafted the Systems Act, the MFMA, the PFMA. Mm-hmm. So we are quite clear and comfortable that the principles underpinned in the Constitution is respected, the provisions and the policy debate in the Systems Act and the Structures Act and the MFMA that was put together is also flowing then through to the regulation. So, we are quite comfortable that that is something from a legislative perspective. If you have a thought in mind, you would have that comfort in mind knowing that. Finalize consultation and consider all comments. We're trying to get this done by the end of January. Conclude the finalized draft by February 2008, that's next month. And then we hope to then conclude and will issue a guide to support practitioners in the implementation. We may have workshops thereafter on the implementation side, like we do with all the other regulations on competencies for the Act, regulations dealing with investment, regulations dealing with debt disclosure and borrowing. We have consultation with municipalities at the regional level, where practitioners attend, councillors attend, and we run through the actual implementation side before giving it an effective date as well for implementation. Chairperson, thank you very much for your time listening to us. I hope the work underpinning this one was quite extensive. There's a whole lot of research that was done to get us to this point. And we would like you to provide any discussion points you'd like to. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, TV. But, that brings us to the end of this marathon presentation slide. But just to indicate that we are a bit concerned as Parliament of the timing of the gazetting of the regulation. You know, December and January for Parliament's consultation is not a very good time. I see it was gazetted on the 13th of November 2007, and Parliament rose just a week later, and comments were open for the public until the end, I mean, until the 13th of December, if I'm not mistaken. I must say that it wasn't a very good time this evening, and that is why you'll find that most of the members, even if they did receive the copies of the gazetted draft, they may not have had the opportunity to look at it. But I'm compatible with your time frames at the end, because that would then allow Parliament an opportunity, as you would see that it touches on a number of committees also. But imagine that these committees would also want to go back and actually look at the impact of these regulations in their respective areas. I would just like want to caution that in future I think we need to try and avoid such situations, because you'll recall that we had a similar situation also with the supply chain management regulations, which were tabled in June, July, when Parliament was in recess. And to say we really would like an opportunity to be able to engage meaningfully with these processes, so that it's not just a matter of really not rubber stamping, but stone stamping. Not only the rubber. We then would like to hear questions, comments from members. I see my co-chair here wants to go first. But then let me just take the names down. Dr. Woods, Mr. Marais, Mr. Smith, Mr. Johnson. Are you writing this? Oh, okay. We'll get the list. Ms. Shilovan. Well, okay. Oh. Mr. Shati, I've got an apology for you. Were you apologizing for coming to the meeting? Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, because normally when I accept your apology, I buy you for speaking, but you are using it. Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by appreciating our ability to meet together as the three portfolio committees. It enables us to look at this issue from a variety of angles, and that can only be good for the kind of work we do with what we are presenting before us. But I'm also very impressed with the politeness of my co-chairperson here in talking about your timing of Gazette industry. Bad news, actually. So that's how radical I can go. So we do really feel very strongly about it. It's not only us, it's also the public that says when we do that, we often are seeking to smuggle things that are not acceptable. That's not our intention. That's not your intention. But that's the impression that people often have when the timing that we use is one during which people can't do anything about stuff. So let's avoid it, generally speaking. I think we appreciate that you often we work because you want stuff to go out. And so that's the only time that you may have found it wrong. But you see, we must avoid perceptions that can be very problematic. What I want to ask you are two things. You worked with DPLG on the General Laws Amendment Act. There's a clause there that spoke about exemptions. I want to know what is the relationship between that clause, we didn't accept it, and this exemptions heavy regulations. The second related one is the am I correct to assume that regulations in terms of the hierarchy can introduce stuff that's new, that's not in a sense that might fly in the face of the principal legislation? Or is it theoretically possible to do that, to introduce new provisions that cover, that deal with issues in a manner that may not have been covered as such in the principal act, and it could be many pieces of legislation, not just one. And that's what we would like to ask. And one of the things that we would have appreciated is an evaluation of the feedback you have received. Who finds this appropriate, these regulations? Who finds it not appropriate? In other words, what are the objections? And what's your response to those objections? The reason that is good to us to hear from you is to help us make a judgment call about how and whether we go for additional public hearings and stuff like that. Okay? So such an evaluation of submissions from yourself would have been very helpful, even if for now you could just identify some of the highlights of objections that you may have received and your response to those objections. Thanks, Chairperson.
Dr. Woods?
Thank you, Chair. My question is basically in the anti-corruption theme. And it concerns disposals rather than transfers, and in particular disposals which would in most cases obviously be to the public. And I'd like to pick up two areas under the disposals. The first concerns decisions made to dispose. And to me, perhaps you could help me, at this point, I find there's insufficient clarity both from a policy and a process point of view of how those disposals will be decided on. When there would be an information statement answering certain questions taken to the council, which the council would agree in principle to the disposal. If the council, in addition, agrees to a public process, there are additional criteria which they must consider. Then this is somehow guided by a rather vague section in supply chain management policy, which is ostensibly more for procurement than the opposite, which is disposal. So I'm not sure how much guidance we get there. So I see, and then coming back to when the disposal actually takes place, how this gets ratified by council. So I need to know that council are being properly informed, not by some council manager who might or might not be honest, who might or might not give them the correct information. So above certain amounts, should there be an audit of that information statement? and at the end of the process, is there a final decision which is stamped by council through a considered process? The second area under disposals is on the valuation side. There too, I'm a little concerned that it might be too vague. If in the absence of an appropriate accounting standard, which is a question in itself, I would have thought that GMAP would have had an accounting standard on that that is consistent to all municipalities. But if there isn't one in existence, surely one could nominate one from GOP perhaps, rather than say in the absence of a clear accounting standard, you can use any one of the following four or five methods. Now, if you look at those methods in practice, those could double, treble in value in assets. So if there's any intention to exploit that, there again, I feel there's some concern. It's a little bit too open.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Murray.
Broken mic. Chair, yes, the one evaluation of assets worried me as well. All those methods, you would get very large discrepancies.
Peter?
Yes.
Are you married to Mr. Murray?
I'm singing a song.
No. You come after Mr. Murray.
Do I? My apologies.
Yeah, you do. And I see Mr. Murray just sitting back. Yeah, okay, Mr. Murray, then it will be you, Peter.
Thank you, Chair. I just thought there's another Mr. Murray. Mr. Chair, the one thing that I must just also jump on the bandwagon is I speak to be corrected, but I think last year we have made that decision that regulations or publications shouldn't appear in the recess period, and it shouldn't be expected from public and other role players to comment during recess period, for instance, the December month. So I just want to support what the two chairpersons have said in that regard. The concern that I've got is that, I mean, the regulations might be very good, the objectives even might be very good. But if we look at the state of many municipalities in South Africa, there are certainly those that you still find in the Auditor General's reports that either their asset registers is not up to date, or they don't have asset registers. So in other words, how can one assure that you know what you've got before you can start to transfer or dispose or sell that? And then, because I mean, it is said that one it appears after due consideration. So in other words, one must expect that there's a lot of subjectivity in the process. In other words, the people at the municipality must apply their minds. And then one must ask, if there's not proper asset registered, then the skills and the ability to apply their minds. How does Treasury make sure that by implementing this, you actually serve the object that this is intended to do, and not, you know, leave a wide door open for people to apply their minds if they haven't got the abilities and skills to do that, and also if there's not proper asset register. Thank you, sir.
Okay, let's take Peter, and perhaps we can then respond to the issues raised before we proceed.
Thank you, Jeff. Sorry for jumping in earlier. Yeah, I've just got a couple of questions on the definition and then one broader question. On the definition, I mean, I'm not in finance, so it's probably a very naive question, but the way the definition of the highest value asset, you know, any of those three, I presume it's the lowest of the three definitions. In other words, it's the lowest of 1,000,005% or what accounts for determined. It can't be even greater of. Otherwise, it wouldn't serve much of a regulatory function. But having said that, assuming that is the case, is a million not rather a low figure? I mean, if you were working on the assumption that 5% is a meaningful figure of an asset base, I can understand it could be a huge figure. But frankly, 1 million rand is barely the price of a second-hand car, you know, high-end car. So I'm just wondering why you pitched at that level to start with. Was the basis of your interaction with municipalities and role players that agreed on this figure? Secondly, again, on the assumption that this is trying to regulate behavior, which is perhaps not ideal, one would not want to easily be in a position where municipalities can circumvent the regulations. So again, just a naive question. Is the distinction between a capital asset and a subsidiary asset perfectly clear? In other words, if I had an asset worth 5 or 6 million, and I didn't want to go through these rules, could I sort of chop it up into 5 or 6 bits of 800,000 each, and thereby circumvent the regulation? And how do you deal with that problem? And then a broader question. The distinction between exempt and non-exempt, I understand in terms of the, if you look at the whole Chapter 8 of the Municipal Structures Act and the service delivery mechanisms and the review thereof, the presentation we've had now, and I haven't had a chance to read the thing in detail, just your presentation, but the presentation is almost premised on public sector versus private. But there's everything in between as well that Chapter 8 provides for, and I haven't heard anything on the in-between. For example, you can have service delivery agreements with NGOs, with CDOs, which you could construe as private in one sense, but some of them are definitely organs of state. For example, a judicial authority is an organ of state. And this is saying, so I'm just trying to get clarity on, does this cover the whole gamut of service delivery agreements, or is it very simply private versus public? Thanks.
Let's take responses to those before we proceed on the next session.
Okay. Thanks, Chairperson. I think the members have raised some very good issues, and it's important that we do discuss them. Firstly, perhaps let me just point to the timing, because I think three or four colleagues, members, have made a similar comment. We've alerted the Energy Committee of the need to process some of the stuff quite soon after their engagement with them, given the need for some guidance and regulations around the framework for disposal. At the moment, there's nothing. So there's a serious absence of this in place. So I wouldn't want to defend the timing, but I think the research and the time for further consultation and engagement was definitely not intended for the purposes that may have been perceived, definitely. Hence, in a letter to Parliament, the Minister has made a request to extend the period beyond the 30 days required in the MFMA for Parliament stuff. So, in fact, I think it's like 60 or 90 days for Parliament has been given to do that. I think we need to refer that so that we definitely took cognizance of Parliament's and members' concerns around that prior to the timing. So let it not be misunderstood, please, that we wanted to do something that was not part of the processes that you would recommend that we follow. So it is there, in terms of the timing that's allowed. So we have, unfortunately, only had time to finish the legal drafting at a certain point through consultation, and hence we went into the time lapse that we were in, the time zone. And so it's no intentional reason for that at all. The processes of securing the legal drafter that had assisted in drafting the Constitution, the Systems Act, the Structures Act, the MFMA, the PFMA, generally gave us the reassurance that the kind of contents of the framework would be legally clean, would be in a way that we could comfortably come to you today and say that the people that have drafted this thing, that have reviewed it, that have looked at it, would have definitely respected the wishes that you had when you drafted the original law. So I think we're quite comfortable in that respect. Hence, again, it mustn't be seen that there's things in here, unless clearly isolated and we can see where the problems lie, that any new stuff is brought in here. If there's enabling provisions in the MFMA, Section 168 of the MFMA was crafted as well for the various committees, including, I think, the Committee on Justice was part of that process, with Local Government Committee and Finance Committee, to ensure that other measures that may not have been expressly contained in specific clauses would have been catered for. Hence, that's where some of the provision, especially section 168, was used to take care of some of the issues that you made. Hopefully, it's all in track, and we have done that. That specific brief was given to the legal drafter to ensure that there is nothing that could be coming into this piece of regulation that would be a challenge. So we will take that from the best legal advice that we had in ensuring that this is then adequately captured. So we're quite comfortable that is then addressed. The objections, and highlight some of them. There's been comment coming through continuously even during the recess period, or the festive season, let's call it that, festive season period, that we've been receiving. So there's something in the range of about 25 comments coming through. In brief, much of the comments were very supportive. So the one position was there is no other regulation like this. So it helps guide people in wanting to do things in a clear process on how to get there, in the absence of anything else. But there is an absence. So that's the first. The second round of comments that came through was, I think, generally comments from a number of Western Cape-based municipalities. With views that there's regulations written that must take consideration of the objectives of local government, must take consideration of the section 154 of the Constitution, which we have done. So those are the kind of common threads, consistent inputs that are coming through. The next, for probably the next area that would have come through was more specifically around the time taken to consult. Is consultation really needed? I think that started to come through in a number of comments, but again, it looks like for me as if there's one legal drafter that has given a different letterhead to place comments. So it appears to be the case from that context, rather than the substance of the comment-making challenge. If we are saying that a key principle for public accountability to be maintained, then one would want to follow these processes in any instance to protect the delivery of minimum basic services. So I think that kind of challenge or kind of initiative of comments that have come through. I may not remember every comment, but in some instances, lengthy comments came through around disposal of land, especially in the usage of land. And in that context, we raised it as a presentation that land would be part of land policy, not this now. So it's an overarching issue around land policy, housing policy, similar issues around housing policy. Comments came through around providing land by municipalities for low-cost housing, and we said yes. So here's the objectives that have been clearly set out in the explanatory memorandum as well. I have captured some of those initiatives. I think there may have been one or two. I know we've received comments from key role players, key stakeholders that could impact directly on some of this. EDI Holdings made their input into this. We're working through some of that as well now to consider a legal regime in where accountability has to be placed for a municipal entity. Is it a municipal council, or is it any other regulatory body that is put in place by national legislation to address the matter? So there's some issues, and we hope that through the other comments that may still be coming in, we hope there's going to be more. So we haven't actually, in effect, stopped receiving comments. Comments are coming through. We are filing them. We're reviewing them very quickly to see where the issues are.
One comment, perhaps just of noting, is that precisely the point around by regulating this thing, are you taking away the autonomy of local government? So it's those kind of comments which have come through, and I think in the presentation and in the earlier part of this, we did say that the legal framework has drafted from taking the foundational law into account, so it is generally covered. So those are some of the broader comments. I may not have covered everything, but it's about 25 sets of inputs. About 10 of them are generally the same, with a different letter exchange. And the others are dealing more specifically with land and housing related matters in much more detail. So I think that's the kind of challenges that we do see. One or two comments is around perhaps on borrowing. Why do you want to ensure that borrowing is associated with assets that is going to be transferred? Some of those comments, I don't know. If you look at them more seriously to see why those comments have come through, but if you want to maintain a jurisdiction that has assets transferred or whichever way, it has to be financially sustainable in the end in any case. And that's one of the principles that we try to explain by government as well. So those are the comments, Jefferson, that we try to review at the moment. We're going to look at, consider all of them to see whether, and if we need to have one-on-one engagement, we will try to do that over the next month before finalizing. That's the intention we have to try and get that on track. But I believe that gives you a sense of where things stand. The National Department of DPLG, I think, given us the minister's concurrence on this regulation, so that was there. I may not have mentioned that earlier as well. So the question around disposal and the link to anti-corruption by a member was, we tried as much as practically possible to ensure that information provided to council is of such a nature that there would be proper information provided. There would be information on the asset, the extent of the asset, the type of the asset, what is it used for, what are the links to those. I think that's the intention, and to start to write every specific provision of what the asset framework was to look at, I think this law, this regulation would be quite extensive. We'd rather put some of that into some of the training material we're doing now, some of the initiatives around process documents and guides that's also provided for in the MFMA, from a number of the aspects, and we probably want to start on a guide on this one, especially now. Linking that question to the accountability and who takes the decision, there's different provisions here which rightly point out council takes the in-principle decision up front to go the route, then further work has to be done, and come back to council for the final decision on the matter. So council will make the decision on that. But if we agree on the threshold level, which we consulted, by the way, that's another comment one of the members have made, whether those levels are minimum or maximum, and if one starts to look at asset registers of municipalities, in many instances the token value of 1 rand placed on an asset. Now, it's going to be quite difficult to set the level either higher or lower, and when we discussed it with practitioners, the point that came across was set it at the level where at least the assets we believe are really needed for essential basic services to be performed has to follow a due process before they are disposed. So I think that's the rationale behind setting those limits. But it's no magic number, granted. Committee members have a different view on that, and it should be set it at 5,000. It's up to them, but the administrative work in getting to any disposal then becomes a much more difficult exercise. So I think that's just linking on to the two kind of questions that let's raise. I hope that provides some response. It may not be the total response. The
So there is a ratification process, and the law, when I read out section 14 of the MFMA, is quite explicit in some instances. When the council makes that decision, it cannot then go and change the decision. So that section that was written in section 14 here, that gives us the kind of way to approach this kind of regulation to ensure that any decision taken then should be a true and proper one of council. We would suggest. Further to that, certain of the other decisions are then also supported by delegations of municipal council. So, in the first instance, when we talked about chapter 2 again, we said that certain issues can be delegated to the accounting officer, and that's based on council policy. If council wishes to change its delegation policy, it's free to do that. We're not regulating or minimizing any delegations by council to take accountability of what they have to do. So that supports the decision-making process. As far as the supply chain policy and disposal policy, I think there's a lot of training taking place on supply chain, and that is perhaps one of the areas where we can strengthen and build further work around to clarify some of the challenges that may be coming across when it's around disposal of that. So I think that would be a good way of trying to address the challenges that we may face. So that supports that process. So final decision. The accounting standards part, as you may know, Member Woods, that there's a whole range of reforms that are still coming, and there's progressive reforms on the table. What we were trying to do was to ensure that the regulation does cover, and the framework covers the different methodologies that are the most common methodologies available. That are used, that are found, that are captured in GAAP as well. So they're not separate, but where we defined it a little bit more in a focused way was definitely in consultation with what the standards are looking at, what are the different approaches that may be taken to give further clarity. Generally what happens when we discuss this draft with practitioners, they were saying, give us something that we need to work for. Don't tell us, go and look at GAAP. We don't know what to actually do, then you're not guiding us. The framework doesn't help us. Give us an option that we can start to look at, and council will take a decision on which is a better option. And I think that, for us, if we set that upfront principle right, it then follows through quite nicely. So it's something that we thought would help rather than hinder any processes going ahead. So that's a valuation and a practice of valuation. Rightfully so, different valuations will provide different results. But that we also say in one of the regulations that it should be a negotiation to finalize what is it, depending on what compensation is realized. So that's there. The member Marie raised issues around the first point was covered by an earlier response, the state of the AG's responses. I think maybe the member needs to be aware that through the competency regulations and the reforms that we're putting in place, it's all phased in. And for those smaller municipalities, there is a staggered date for certain of the real practical implications of some of the asset-related matters. There's an exemption notice that was issued just June, July last year, to all municipalities, asking them to write to the Treasury for relief from the provisions of the GAMAF standards and GRAP standards, the applicability of that. They're largely for the medium and low capacity municipalities that we've categorized. And in that instance, there was a number of requests received and a number of granted approval. So the concern around whether the municipalities are able to apply the principles contained in this regulation, I think it's clear that we want them to apply. It's clear that there's a project that we're concluding now. By next month, we probably can publish an asset register guide for asset management, which will capture the broader issues around asset registry and asset management, what, how to look at it and the rationale around that, which will support this as well. So it's a two or three different projects that they are running in tandem though. So hope that will address the challenge around what to do, what not to do in an asset disposal, whether you have the information or not. I think it would be wise then that those municipalities do come on board. We are helping municipalities out to get to that stage of preparing this, although it's a transition to get there. I think that covers largely the comments that Member Marie raised. And Member Smith, I think the definitions on high we responded to, so that was covered. Many can circumvent the issues. I think I don't know how we can start to help this out further besides putting something further in the guide and supporting training material to have ethical practices put in place. You know, well, what you're referring to, I think, is I'm not sure there's lawyers around the room how we can write a law that will stop everything. If people want to be innovative and try to circumvent the system, it's going to be a very difficult exercise. Perhaps by there may be a need in a guide when we issue it to say that the intention is to do it in a specific way that will probably address your query around splitting up of assets to below the threshold so that it's circumvented. So we can probably deal with that, and I think that comment is quite critical to make. But I would recommend that is part of the guide that we can issue to improve the practice. Then the chapter 8, the in-between issue. Yes, we thought the in-between issue would be suited in any one of those as we defined it. We tried to define it in such a way that an organ of state would cover the aspects that you were referring to. If you're an organ of state, then you would fall within that regime, and that chapter then would apply to you. If you're a private entity, corporate, the Companies Act, and any other mission, then that is what you would be doing, and you would follow that chapter regime that has been drafted for you. And the other way that the catch-all type of provision that may have been something that could not have been foreseen is the right of use, the leasing, the use of the municipal assets by another party, another outside of either the organ or private or whichever way. We could use that part. But we will look at that definition to see if we need to strengthen it further. I think that comment definitely will see how we can close gaps if there's gaps available. On. Thank you. Jefferson, I think. Okay, the one challenge query that came about, and we may have to look at it a little further again, but we believe that exemption that was contained in the laws amendment though relates specifically to exemptions from section 78 of the Systems Act. I think that was the context in which that was drafted, if my memory serves me right, or the colleagues can remember. If that was the context, then we wouldn't be able to cover that in the regulation under the MFMA. That needed to be covered there. I'm not sure within
which context. My question was, what is the relationship between that and this? Not whether you cover it here.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh. No, I think then we've addressed that.
Okay, you can come back later on it here.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, I still have a list of hands, but I'm informed that tea is ready. We'll break for tea and come back and proceed with the list.